Hello, and welcome to episode number 51 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. In last week's episode, I postulated that part of the reason why it's so difficult to make sense of the actions of the intelligence behind the UFO phenomenon is because in reality, that broad range of activity is not the result of a single actor. The data ends up looking nonsensical and contradictory to us because in one case, a so-called alien intelligence says or does one thing, and then in the next case, it does the seeming opposite. But as I argued, that apparent contradiction only exists when we assume a single intelligence and agenda is involved. From my point of view, the reality is anything but. I think what we're dealing with is a multidimensional multiverse, absolutely teeming with life. And while trickster phenomena are undoubtedly in the mix, that alone, from my point of view, doesn't explain the bizarre mishmash of actions we see evidenced in the data. Again, I think the wide range of activity and messages attributed to these others makes most sense when we think about them as being different groups, often with different agendas as well as different sources/origins. I also made the point in last week's episode that while various researchers tend to focus on one subset of the data, while ignoring, dismissing, or downplaying the rest, this is the wrong approach, especially if our goal is to gain a greater understanding as to the totality of what's going on, and more importantly, to gain further clarity on the very fabric of ultimate reality. I think our approach should be to attempt to identify patterns within the totality of the data. And as we do that, I think we'll find that one particular hypothesis might better fit one aspect of the data, while perhaps a different hypothesis better fits a different segment. In other words, in no way should we consider these various hypotheses to be mutually exclusive. In fact, I think it's only in combining them within some overarching meta-conception that we can hope to achieve some semblance of clarity as to the source and nature of these various mysterious others. In addition to the confusion that can arise when we have data that effectively is a jumble of activity based on many different kinds of non-human intelligence, one aspect of that data that seems particularly confounding is the regularly reported humanoid form of these so-called aliens. Now, on the one hand, one might want to disregard these reports as being an anthropocentric tendency based on people who didn't see very clearly during a certain contact or abduction experience, or who are suffering from a failing memory. And that might work for one or a few cases. But as I already stated, these humanoid forms are described again and again and again in the UFO phenomenon literature, so much so that we surely can't explain this all away as blatant, inherent bias in this broad assortment of witnesses. Not very long ago on this podcast, we discussed the future human hypothesis and how this helps to elegantly explain why these others so often appear to not only be humanoids, but actually hominids. In other words, biological beings directly descended from human beings. But are there other possibilities that deserve consideration as a plausible explanation for their uncanny resemblance to us? I believe there are, and we'll explore both those possibilities as well as how various proposed hypotheses might weave together to form a fabric robust enough to contain the plurality of alien others that have been reported over time. In this, the 51st episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to bring to your attention that this is part two of a two-part series that we began last week in episode 50. So if you haven't heard that yet, you might want to go back and listen to that first and then return to this episode number 51. Now, in that episode last week, I mentioned that this week we would pick up where we left off and talk about the different hypotheses, the broad brush hypotheses that attempt to make sense of the data we see in the UFO phenomenon. Now, of course, number one that everyone is aware of is the extraterrestrial hypothesis. This is the notion that these are non-human intelligences. They are biological beings who are coming from planets tied to star systems, tied to galaxies. They may be coming from our own galaxy or from far away, from a galaxy even further away than the Milky Way. But bottom line is that they are biological beings who traveled here either through advanced spacecraft or by a combination of advanced spacecraft and something like wormholes that would allow them to warp space-time and get here much more quickly and much more efficiently. That's number one, the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Next up, we have the interdimensional hypothesis. Now, as I've mentioned many times on this podcast, Jacques Vallée and J. Allen Hynek ended up championing this kind of hypothesis, even though they began as proponents of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. The reason why they began to question the extraterrestrial hypothesis is because there was so much high strangeness in the data. And remember, these are firsthand researchers going in and interviewing witnesses, family, friends, coworkers of these witnesses, gathering as much on-the-ground data as is available, and then trying to make sense of that data. And again, because there was so much high strangeness, so many apparent paranormal activities that seemed to co-arise with the arising of these supposed extraterrestrials, both people like Vallée and Hynek, who at one point worked together, concluded that this is perhaps not extraterrestrial in nature. Now, in Jacques Vallée's case, he also later on went and investigated, researched in-depth fairy lore. We're specifically talking mostly about European fairy lore from ancient history and how that relates to similarities with reports from supposed modern UFO sightings and interactions with supposed aliens. What Vallée saw was that there was a lot of overlap, even in terms of the appearance as well as the actions of these others. And so Vallée began to wonder, perhaps these aren't different groups at all, but rather the same group over time, just seen differently because of our expectations, our conceptions. Obviously, for modern human beings, the final frontier is outer space at this point in our development. And so when we run into beings that seem so other to us, our initial assumption is they must be aliens, space aliens, in other words, biological beings arising from other planets and traveling here in sophisticated spacecraft. Of course, that wasn't the assumption in the Middle Ages, for instance, in Europe. So their lens might have been different, which led them to interpret the experience differently and come to different conclusions about the origin of these others, that they were namely magical creatures that could appear out of nowhere, basically. And it's important to note here that it may be that this is just about human beings and our lens, our bias, and how we apply that to things we come across differently over time. But it may also be the case that some sort of combination or mutuality or relationship exists where our perceptions, our expectations also play a role in what we actually end up experiencing, especially if these beings somehow are not embodied in quite the same way we think of beings as likely to be. If they are not densely embodied like us, or if they have a different modality they can take on, then perhaps they are a combination of something real and biological or semi-biological, but they're also to some degree a reflection of our own expectations. Again, there's a lot of complexity here, but this is basically the notion that people like Vallée came to. And just to make that abundantly clear, with this interdimensional hypothesis, we're talking about beings, perhaps biological, perhaps some combination of biological and energetic, coming from a different reality, perhaps a parallel Earth or a parallel universe that can pop in and out of our reality. And this explains their ability to show up suddenly and then disappear suddenly, and also explains why we only come across them in certain situations and when certain conditions are met. So that's the first two, the extraterrestrial hypothesis and the interdimensional hypothesis. Now, it should be said that in popular culture, the extraterrestrial hypothesis is still the most common one you come across when people think about UFOs. Even when you pay attention to modern media discussing what's going on in Congress in terms of establishing official bodies designed to study this phenomenon, if they talk about something off-world, they mean extraterrestrial. That's really the only possibility that's being considered beyond conventional prosaic human explanations at this point. But for those who have a deep familiarity with this data, the intradimensional hypothesis is probably the more common one adhered to. But it's also important here to point out that it could be some combination of the two. In other words, we could have beings that did arise on some planet in some far-flung star system, but in an alternate reality to ours. So in that sense, you have a combination of the two. And I always like to say to people, don't become too wooden, too concretized in how you think about these different hypotheses, because our view of reality itself may be somewhat wanting. In fact, I'm pretty sure it is, and therefore we should hold all of this lightly. So that takes care of the first two hypotheses that are most commonly put forward to make sense of this phenomenon. Of course, there are others. Now, we last week also talked about the extra-dimensional hypothesis. And here I'm talking about a notion of beings who are coming from outside a space-time construct altogether. So let's make sense of this. Initially, you have kind of a view where there is one universe, and that is the sum total of everything. And if beings are coming here who are not conventionally human and not even native to the Earth, then they must be coming from some other location in the cosmos, in the one cosmos that is the totality of everything. And again, most likely we think of them as coming from some planet in some star system, in some galaxy. Now, intradimensional takes it one step further and says, perhaps, according to the many worlds hypothesis, there are multiple universes, multiple worlds. That's where the many worlds notion comes from. And that these others may be coming here from one of those other realities, those parallel realities. It could even be a parallel Earth. So in that sense, a long distance is not really the issue. It's about transversing that membrane between realities, that perhaps that's what these beings are doing. But with the extra-dimensional hypothesis, we're not talking about either of those possibilities. We're suggesting that there may be beings who exist outside of that space-time construct altogether, who are not members of the multiverse as we think about it. Rather, they are, according to some people's conceptions, very close to the central source of the entire multiverse, the creator, if you will, the ultimate intelligence behind everything. There are various reasons why people think about these beings in this way. Partly it's because they remind them of angels in the sense that they are not only seemingly composed of light and not matter, but because they are often described as very good beings, benevolent beings who mean us well. When you think about guardian angels, people are talking about these types of beings, these celestial types. As I mentioned in last week's episode, angels, demons, and Dorothy Izett's beings of light all fall within the celestial categories, beings that do not seem to be embodied at all, don't seem to be biological at all, and don't seem to arise from within the space-time construct at all. So that's the extra-dimensional hypothesis. And as I describe these various hypotheses, I want you to keep in mind that what I'm suggesting is that different hypotheses can describe different aspects of the data. So you might take a subset of the data, notice a certain pattern occurring, and it might fit one type of entity, perhaps interdimensional, perhaps extraterrestrial, or based on what we just talked about, perhaps extradimensional. And only by combining all of these do we then end up with something that looks like a more complete picture of what people are encountering over time. Now, while those hypotheses we just mentioned are the most common, another one that's arisen more recently that has gained a lot of credibility is the so-called future human hypothesis. Now, we discussed this over three different episodes quite recently, so if you are familiar with those episodes, you know exactly what I'm talking about. For those of you who are not so familiar, the idea is that because some of these grays look so much like us, this suggests that they are, in fact, our very biological descendants, that have time traveled back from the future to our time period. This notion, this hypothesis, is developed quite elegantly in Michael Master's excellent book, Identified Flying Objects. And he calls these beings extratempestrials because actually they are not from here, they are from here, but they're from outside of our time. Therefore, they're extratempestrial beings, not extraterrestrial beings. So if you have a history with this phenomenon, with this literature behind UFOs and alien beings, you've probably heard of each of the previous hypotheses I just outlined. Now let's touch on a couple that you may not have heard of. The first is the so-called psychosocial hypothesis. The idea here is that psychosocial dynamics, archetypes, and collective psi phenomena, and even mass hysteria, can play a role in the arising of these entities. Now, while you may at first balk at this notion because it seems to mock the idea that these could actually be real, but rather they're hallucinations arising from mass hysteria, like we said, or some sort of collective delusion, it's not quite that simple, because when you look into the psi spectrum, for instance, with human beings and the history of entities such as egregores or tulpas, you find that there actually apparently are historical cases where human beings have gotten together and collectively been able to actually assign certain characteristics to some imaginary being who then takes on some sort of independent existence. In other words, it's not just in the collective shared imagination of a certain group of people, but that in some way, this entity takes on an ontological status that goes beyond just the imagination of those people. Furthermore, there have been cases in the historical literature where some of these entities that have taken life based on the intentionality expressed by a group of people and then been able to interact with those very people after the fact and even manifest in physical reality, for instance, shaking a table or moving a chair in a room. Now, I understand if you're coming from more of a nuts and bolts perspective, not only to the UFO phenomenon, but to life in general, to the fabric of reality, that's going to sound outlandish to you. All I would say to you is that there is quite a bit of evidence for this. And especially when you go outside of Western civilization and some of the assumptions of reductive materialism, this is actually quite common. This is an expectation in some other cultures. And again, to make it clear, there have been cases even within Western civilization where such attempts like this have been successful. So I just want to make that clear that we're talking about two different kinds of psychosocial phenomena here. On the one hand, you have something like mass hysteria or collective delusion, which suggests that nothing is really going on behind the scenes. But you also have cases where psychosocial effects can arise that actually seem to imbue certain entities with an ontological status. They become real. Again, I understand that for some of you, some of these notions will sound quite outlandish. But again, there is quite a bit of evidence for them. We will go into this in greater detail in future podcast episodes when we have more time to devote specifically to this topic. But just generally, let me say that there are sort of three different kinds of thought form kind of entities: tulpas, egregores, and servitors. Now, a tulpa is created by a person and is a thought form that has autonomy and some degree of free will. Then you have an egregore, which is pretty much like a tulpa, except that it's the product of several people with combined consciousness intention. And finally, you have a servitor, which is specifically an entity created to serve a human being. You might think of it like an astral robot. Again, everything I just described would fall within the psychosocial hypothesis. Now, there is one other hypothesis put forward to explain the UFO phenomenon that I'd also like to make you aware of. Perhaps you've heard of this before, perhaps you haven't, but like some of the others, it does explain why these beings often look so humanoid. Basically, the idea is that these beings are basically human, and that this is part of a breakaway civilization. And this is therefore the breakaway civilization hypothesis, most commonly associated with UFO researcher and historian Richard Dolan. Now, there are some pretty fascinating historical details that might tie into this, but the long and short of it is that when you think back to the mystery airships of the late 1800s and early 1900s, this is supposedly the result of technological experiments being conducted by a certain group that was further ahead than other human civilization in terms of technology. And this makes some sense when you think about the mystery airships, because while they were futuristic compared to what human beings were doing at the time, they weren't very far ahead, perhaps a decade or two. So that would align with the notion that there was a certain group of human beings who had leapfrogged others. Furthermore, experiments done by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s are also thought to be connected to this supposed breakaway civilization, and that the Die Glocke, the bell program, perhaps was able to not only accommodate space travel, but may also have been a kind of time travel vehicle. Now, that may be a lot to take in, but there is interesting historical details that perhaps may tie into this. And I would recommend Nick Cook's excellent book, The Hunt for Zero Point, if you're interested in this particular hypothesis. And by the way, we will go into this in greater detail in a future episode that we can dedicate specifically to this breakaway civilization hypothesis. Okay, now that we've covered some of the conventional as well as some of the unconventional hypotheses put forward to explain the UFO phenomenon, let's now move to the second part of the discussion, which I mentioned in the introduction, that has to do with the humanoid form of these others that is come across so often in their literature. Again, to be very specific, very, very often these creatures have two arms, two legs, two eyes, a nose, some semblance of ears. They look basically humanoid, even though there are some details that are different. Perhaps the color of the skin is more gray. The eyes, of course, are often larger. The nose, mouth, and ears are somewhat more receded into the face or the head, and the cranium is often larger. But overall, you have a very humanoid form. So, of course, we're confronted with the question, why do these others, these supposed aliens, look so humanoid and sometimes even more than that, quite human? On the one hand, this flies in the face of common sense, which tends to suggest that beings arising on some completely different planet under a completely different set of environmental conditions and different accidents of evolutionary history would not tend to evolve to look so much like us. According to common sense, that might seem almost impossible. And this leads people to believe either that these aliens are actually somehow connected to us, or that they don't exist at all and people are basically just imagining them. Furthermore, when you consider Masters' case that he makes in his book, Identified Flying Objects, the case seems even more sound, that these may indeed be human beings or some semblance of human beings, a future evolutionary form of human beings who are time traveling into our time period. And that's because to him, based on his background as an evolutionary biologist with a specialty in hominid form, he believes it is clear they must share a genetic lineage both with us and other primates such as chimpanzees. Again, it's a solid case. It's a very strong case. I think we have to take it very seriously. But that said, it's also worth asking, are there other hypotheses put forward, other explanations that could potentially explain why these others look so commonly humanoid and even somewhat human? Why would this be the case? Is there any possibility that could explain this beyond them being time-traveling future humans, basically? Well, as it turns out, I think there are some other possibilities that definitely deserve consideration. And I'd like to touch on several of those now. Now, one possibility arises as an implication of a hypothesis we already discussed, and that is the interdimensional hypothesis. It could be that these are dimension-hopping denizens of an alternate Earth, or beings that kind of cohabitate between here and some alternate Earth. That would explain why they look humanoid and often quite human. And that's because they may have followed a similar evolutionary trajectory to a certain point, and then perhaps it diverged in some ways because of different environmental conditions that arose on that alternate Earth. That would explain why they look so much like us, but not exactly like us. Another possibility that would explain why there seem to be different beings, both aliens and us, the human denizens of this planet, that share such a common humanoid form, that could of course arise from some sort of vast ancient seeding program, perhaps undertaken by some ancient but sophisticated alien intelligence. Now, of course, conventional science doesn't consider that possibility because it sounds quite outlandish and it requires the assistance of some ancient, sophisticated civilization. That's a fair point. This option may fail the Occam razor's test, but it's still a possibility. Many astrophysicists do believe that it's quite likely that some life in the universe is going to be much older than ours, perhaps billions of years older than ours. And if those particular civilizations evolved to take to space travel, they may have conducted some sort of cosmic seeding program throughout the galaxy or perhaps even further. And that's why you get these different groups arising that look so similar, because they arise from the same origin or source that basically spreads seed across the galaxy. And in fact, when you hear about some researchers suggesting that the Earth is kind of like a petri dish and some ancient, sophisticated alien civilization is looking in on us like an experiment, that would also fit with this idea of a cosmic seeding program. Another possibility that could explain this is MacTonnie's crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. This is the notion that perhaps there is a sister humanoid species that evolved here on the Earth and is within our timeline. But at some point they separated from us and perhaps either live underground or in the oceans and may possess the capacity to be able to disguise themselves or cloud our consciousness so that we're only aware of them on certain occasions and under certain conditions. That's a possibility as well. Here we're talking about a sister humanoid species from this Earth, not a different one, and from our very own timeline. Another possibility that I would like to discuss that I think is very promising is a notion called convergent evolution. And to discuss this possibility, I want to draw some quotes from a book by Eric Kirschenbaum titled The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy. Opening his book, this is what Kirschenbaum has to say. Quote, "We are increasingly confident that there is life elsewhere in the universe, and even more excitingly, that it might be possible to find it. In 2015, NASA's chief scientist, Ellen Stofan, predicted that we will have evidence of life on other planets within 20 to 30 years. Of course, she was talking about microbes or their alien equivalent, not necessarily intelligent life. But the principle is still staggering. We have gone from being obsessed with the possibility of alien life at the beginning of the 20th century to complacent pessimism in the 70s and 80s, and now back to a realistic scientific optimism. This book is about how we can use that realistic scientific approach to draw conclusions with some confidence about alien life, and intelligent alien life in particular." Unquote. Now, Kirschenbaum goes on to explain how mechanisms are key to zoologists. And quoting from his book again, quote, "Contrary to what some people think, zoologists such as myself don't just spend our time identifying and classifying animals. Like scientists in all disciplines, we attempt to explain what we see in the world around us. Zoology and evolutionary biology in general is about proposing mechanisms for explaining the nature of life. Why do lions live in prides, but tigers hunt alone? Why do birds have only two wings? Why, for that matter, do the vast majority of animals have a left side and a right side? Observation is not enough. We want to derive a set of rules for life, in the same way that physicists derive rules for planets and stars. If those biological rules are universal rules, they will work as well on another planet as the law of gravity." Unquote. This is such a significant point that Kirschenbaum is making, and when you think about it, it's commonsensical, actually. It's intuitive. There was a time when we used to think that planets in far-off star systems in different galaxies would be very, very different. In fact, it was kind of the in vogue thing to imagine really, really strange planets, really, really strange alien life. But the truth is, the same elements compose the universe everywhere, and there's a certain consistency across the vast expanse of space. That's why we can make observations or predictions about exosolar planets and exogalactic planets, because we assume there is a consistency across the cosmos. And in the same way, Kirschenbaum is arguing, it makes sense that there would be consistent mechanisms which evolution would use to solve certain problems. Because again, evolution and natural selection in particular are not thought to be just unique to the Earth. Just like hydrogen and helium are found throughout the cosmos, the idea is that evolutionary processes also exist across the cosmos, and they are what give rise to life. And because of that, by even looking at the life we find here on the Earth, we can make strong predictions about what we're likely to find on exosolar and exogalactic planets. I'd like to quote now from Kirschenbaum's book when he goes into this in greater detail. This is about solutions to universal problems. Quote, "We want to investigate questions that astrobiologists rarely consider. What might complex alien life look like? Can we draw any concrete conclusions about the ecology and behavior of alien life using the tools and clues we have available on Earth? a zoologist observing a newly discovered continent from afar would be buzzing with ideas about what kind of creatures might live there. Those ideas wouldn't be wild speculations, but keenly reasoned hypotheses based on the huge diversity of animals we already know and how each animal's adaptations are well suited for the life they live, how they eat, sleep, find mates, and build their dens. The more we know about how animals have adapted to the old world, the better we can speculate about the new. This is the approach I'm going to use when talking about alien life. As different as it may be, there are still some things that we can learn from how life makes its living on Earth. The evolutionary processes that we observe here are due to pressures and mechanisms that are also very likely to occur elsewhere. Movement, communication, cooperation, these are evolutionary outcomes that are solutions to universal problems. Unquote. Now again, according to Kirschenbaum, a notion such as convergent evolution might explain why we can expect aliens to perhaps look quite like us and have developed mechanisms to solve similar problems that all species, all life is likely to encounter as they evolve in environments such as planets. Now earlier we mentioned that Masters suggested that the fact that these humanoid aliens look so much like us suggests they must be related to us, a direct genetic lineage. But according to Kirschenbaum, that's not necessarily the case. And here we can look to examples of what he calls, again, convergent evolution. This is where a similar evolutionary trait is developed without different species being related in any direct way. And he gives the example of flight and how that's been evolved as a trait four different times on the Earth for species that are unrelated. Quoting again from his book, quote, "In fact, we know that powered flight evolved at least four times on Earth. Birds evolved flight around 150 million years ago when dinosaurs roamed the Earth. The famous fossil Archaeopteryx, dating from around this time, appears to be halfway between a dinosaur and a bird and caused much consternation and scratching of heads among scientists in the 19th century, including Charles Darwin. Bats, on the other hand, didn't evolve to fly until a little more than 50 million years ago, almost certainly after the extinction of the dinosaurs. Bird wings and bat wings are so strikingly different that it is hard to believe they perform similar functions. Bats have tremendously elongated fingers, which stretch to the rear edge of each wing, with a thin membrane in between, rather like the web feet of ducks, except that the webbing extends all the way up the arm as well. Birds, of course, have feathers rather than skin covering their wing, but unlike bats, their bones only run along the very leading edge of the wing, with feathers trailing behind them. Despite the fact that the flight of birds and bats evolved quite separately, the uses to which flight has been put are very similar. If you watch swallows and swifts darting through the air to catch flying insects on the wing, they look remarkably like the bats you'd see a few hours later at dusk, flitting around after insects just like a bird. The tiny Nathusius pipistrelle bat, weighing about 10 grams, manages to migrate hundreds or even thousands of kilometers, rivaling the long-distance journeys of many birds. Whatever its origin, flight is an incredibly useful function, and it isn't surprising that it crops up again and again." Unquote. So again, what Kirschenbaum is saying here is that when a hugely beneficial evolutionary trait exists, it's likely to be developed even among species that are not directly related. Now, Kirschenbaum finishes with this key point: convergence should apply everywhere. Quoting one more time from his book, quote, "And here is the main point. Convergent evolution is not just a phenomenon restricted to life on Earth. The same principles that lead birds and bats to evolve similar solutions will also lead alien birds and bats to fly. There is nothing special about Earth or about the very distant familial relationship between birds and bats. Convergence between species on different planets that occupy similar niches is almost certain to occur." Unquote. So I don't know about you, but I found that very fascinating, this notion of convergent evolution, and perhaps this might explain why the humanoid form is actually quite common across the galaxy and perhaps even in exogalactic environments, because it's a very beneficial solution that the evolutionary process has served up in numerous locations across the cosmos. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying this notion of convergent evolution therefore makes more sense than Master's idea that the Greys must be future humans. In fact, both might even be going on. All I think we should conclude from this is that we shouldn't be too quick to jump to one conclusion and to hold to it. We should keep an open mind and explore other possibilities. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. And I'd like to offer a huge thank you to those who have become patrons. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.